Turn to Luke chapter 16, please. Verse 19. I want to talk about the rich man and Lazarus, which is a familiar story, I'm sure, to everyone here. But when we're talking about the afterlife and heaven and hell, and really particularly when the question comes up about, well, where are people between dying and the general resurrection, you always have to come across this parable because it's much of what happens takes place in Hades. Exactly what they mean, we need to talk about. So, Luke 16:19. There was a rich man who was clothed in purple and fine linen, by the way, in those days. I think most people know purple was rare and the indicator of great expense and hence wealth. But linen was also expensive, and it was usually worn as underwear. So what he's saying is the rich man was so rich he had the best underwear. Because the linen was the, you had wool outer garments in those days, and of course you're in the Mediterranean climate. I mean, you've seen how people dress, right? They weren't wearing linen as a rule, but undergarments were linen. One major invention, big advance for civilization, was to come up with non-woolen underwear. Not many people could afford it in those days. And he feasted sumptuously every day. And, of course, these were people, the Jews, were occupied by the Romans who charged them taxes and tribute. And they often lived on the edge of survival. And so to have a great feast every day meant incredible, very rare wealth. And at his gate was laid a poor man named Lazarus, covered with sores, who desired to be fed with what fell from the rich man's table. Moreover, even the dogs came and licked his sores, which is nasty enough to our ears, right? But dogs were considered unclean. So he couldn't go to temple without having gone through a purification ceremony, which, of course, he could never do because he wasn't well-fed and didn't have a way to escape his situation. And the poor man died and was carried by the angels to Abraham's side. Does anybody have a different translation other than Abraham's side?
Where are you reading this?
Luke 16.
16.
Yeah, 22. Abraham's bosom. Yeah, I say in modern English we don't talk about Abraham's bosom much or any man's bosom. The concept is in those days when you went out, when you ate a meal, particularly a feast, you didn't do like we do and sit in a chair at a table. They had couches that lined up kind of in a circle or semicircle around a table. And you would lay on the couch, typically on your left side, and with your right hand you would dip into the plate and grab a handful of food, forks and knives and spoons, you know, still things being worked out, mainly you ate with your hands. And so it's an odd picture to us. I mean, we don't see it at all. And can you imagine inviting people to your house and putting a bunch of cots around the dinner table and having the dinner table 2 feet off the ground and everybody grabbing, okay, but that's how they did it, and that was the Roman way, and to be in Abraham's bosom was to be the person in the cot in front of Abraham, if he were sitting, it'd be at his right-hand side, it's the direction he's facing, all right, so he would be in the place of highest honor, the irony, of course, is very intentional. The poor man was in the place of great degradation, of misery and in the worst place he could be in that society, even among the dogs, and they thought very poorly of dogs in ancient Palestine, and they were unclean. But in the afterlife, he's at Abraham's bosom. He's in the most honored place. And we don't see it in the language, but it's there. He's at dinner with Abraham. He's eating in the great banquet of the afterlife that the prophet spoke about, Isaiah particularly, spoke of the afterlife, or when the new kingdom comes, that we're all going to eat together in a great feast or banquet. And of course, the Revelation echoes that, right? And we're invited to the feast of the bridegroom and the bride. And Jesus, throughout his Gospels, his teaching is constantly talking about inviting people to dinner. That's one of his favorite stories. It starts with, and so there was an invitation to a bridal dinner, or a wealthy man wanted to invite people to a party. It's all about inviting people to eat. Well, those were all echoes of the prophets who speak of the afterlife in terms of a great dinner, great feast. So we have the poor man in a great feast with Abraham. Why Abraham?
Father of the
Jews? Yeah. And a friend of God. But we don't read in the Old Testament that, you know, when you die, if you're a good person, you will go to be with Abraham. But that's what Jesus seems to be saying. But see, Abraham in this picture, in this story, he kind of serves the same role when we talk about St. Peter. Right? And some archaeologists were to dig up an old sermon from this time, and there's a story told at the beginning of the sermon about dying, going to heaven, and meeting St. Peter at the pearly gates. Right? Well, St. Peter is kind of a stock character in our heaven stories, in our time and culture. Right? It's based on the fact that Jesus said, "You have the keys to the kingdom of heaven. On this rock, I'll build my church." But it's really just a great way to set up a story. Right? I spent my childhood being told, now, of course, the story begins with St. Peter, but we all know he's really not the gatekeeper of heaven. He's not really a saint. We're all saints. But after we got our theology straight, we're still going to tell the story about St. Peter, because that's how stories start. Right? Abraham kind of served that role in the first century. It's not that the Bible said, when you die to go to heaven, you'll be in Abraham's bosom. It was, of course, Abraham's in heaven, and he's the father of the Jews, and he would be there. And he was thought of almost like a superhero, as, you know, the way they thought of him. And so he was the hero of the Jews. He is the guy who made all this possible. So, of course, I want to be honored and be with Abraham. The rich man died also and was buried, and in Hades. If you have the NIV, what does it say? In verse 23. Hades? Hell. Greek is Hades. King James is hell. It's a little ambiguous, but Hades usually is, in the Old Testament and among the Greeks and the Jews of the first century, the place where the dead are. And the Old Testament would say Sheol. So he's where the dead are. Now we know he's in the bad part of where the dead are, because you're about to be told about fire and torture and torment. Okay, but he's not saying he's in Gehenna necessarily. he is in the realm of the dead, which is Hades. Now, according to Revelation, what happens at the end of time to Hades? Anybody know? Do it. Burns up. Yeah, Revelation 20, we see Hades and death being thrown into the lake of fire. So this presumably is taking place before then, because there is no Hades after the general resurrection, which is kind of hard for us to imagine, because Hades is where the dead are. You know, and dead got to be somewhere, right? But Hades is the grave, and there's going to be no more death. And after general resurrection, we're living in the new heavens and new earth, where heaven and earth are merged, and we're going to live forever. So there is no need for graves or graveyard language or an afterlife. We are in the afterlife, but we're not out there somewhere. We're in the new heavens and new earth, with earth and heaven combined. So although the commentators debate this like they debate everything, seems pretty clear. Jesus is not talking about what things will be like after the resurrection. After all, we're going to have conversations with people who are still alive. So he's in Hades, the realm of the dead, being in torment. He lifted up his eyes and saw Abraham far off and Lazarus at his side, and he called out, "Father Abraham, have mercy on me and send Lazarus to tip the end of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am in anguish in this flame." But Abraham said, "Child, remember that you in your lifetime received your good things and Lazarus in like manner bad things. But now he is comforted and you are in anguish." Kind of, well, you had your chance, dude, right? "And besides all this, between us and you, a great chasm has been fixed in order that those who would pass from here to you may not be able." Now, why would anybody want to leave paradise, or Abraham's bosom, and go to the place of torment?
Comfort someone they loved.
Yeah, perhaps so. I mean, it's interesting to say we're going to try to keep people out of hell. Most people would not want to go to hell, particularly if you're sitting there able to see it and hear it, the screams of agony and people begging for mercy. It's not like you'd want to go. But Abraham says the chasm was created so you can't go even if you wanted to, and it may be that mercy can't be shown. And none may cross from there to us, which, of course, they would if they could. And he said, "Then I beg you, Father, to send him to my father's house, for I have five brothers, so that he may warn them, lest they also come into this place of torment." But Abraham said, "They have Moses and the prophets. Let them hear them." And he said, "No, Father Abraham, but if someone goes to them from the dead, they will repent." He said to him, "If they do not hear Moses and the prophets, neither will they be convinced by someone if someone should rise from the dead." Now, that's just a marvelous bit of storytelling, right? And at the end, you have to think about what?
Jesus.
Jesus resurrected. And in fact, most Jews did not repent. We learned that from Romans 11. Most of the Jewish nation rejected Jesus, even though he was resurrected. Who else would that make you think of in the Gospels besides Jesus?
Lazarus.
Lazarus, yeah. Lazarus rose from the dead. And that was just before the triumphal entry and at the end of Jesus' ministry. And, it did get people pretty excited about Jesus, but it didn't cause people to repent and accept Jesus as Messiah. So I don't know if it was intentional or not. One of the questions that people ask is, why does Lazarus have a name when all the other characters in Jesus' stories don't have names? And then you remember, well, there was a real guy named Lazarus who really did come back from the dead. And it happened just at the end of Jesus' ministry. And it clearly was Jesus who did it, and yet, do we see massive repentance and turning back to God? No. So, that may be the connection. Don't know. The question that, for our purposes, this summer, is we're talking about the afterlife, is how does this fit into the story of the afterlife? And the answer is, to me, and you're welcome to disagree with me, because even the great commentators disagree over all kinds of issues about this, is it doesn't. It's a story to make a point. It makes it brilliantly. But the details of the story are not the point. The story is the point. Now, for example, according to the story, how is it that Lazarus made it to Abraham's bosom? How was he transported?
By the angels.
A beautiful picture, right? Well, was it his soul or his body that got transported?
Sounds like his body.
Sounds like his body, but we know his body stayed on earth, right? I mean, we don't really think that his body got angelically transferred up into heaven at this time. There's a wrong time for that, right? That happened later.
Where did the angels come from?
Well, it came from God. And where, you know, where they came from, you know, I don't know. God must have made them. But there were angels that transported his soul, presumably up to heaven. And yet, when there's conversations going on between Abraham and the rich man, they're talking about thirst and fingers, like he's embodied. Right? How could Lazarus bring just a fingerful of water down to Hades, to the torment place, if he didn't have a finger? And if he's just a disembodied soul, that doesn't really quite make sense. And yet we know his body is on earth because the resurrection hadn't happened yet. So some commentators say, well, maybe this is really talking about after the resurrection. Well, if it's after the resurrection, how can you go rescue five brothers who are still on earth? I mean, they would have already, but everybody got resurrected at once. So that doesn't make sense, you see. So if we try to be too literal about it, it kind of falls apart. It doesn't fit. And so what happens is everybody takes whatever their preferred theory is, and they pick the part of the story they like, and they say, therefore, my theory is right and everybody else is wrong. Trouble is, when you, no matter what theory you take, you're going to find some parts of the story you have to disregard. Doesn't work. And as a result, most commentators take the view that this is kind of, I mean, the point Jesus is making is a true point, and there really is going to be punishment and torment for bad people. And the rich are going to find their roles with the poor reversed in the afterlife. All that's true. The principles, the lessons, the morals are all true. But the details of what the afterlife is going to be like is not necessarily this. Because Abraham, this is what really bothered me the first time I thought about it, was Abraham's in heaven and he can hear the rich man screaming in agony. What kind of heaven would it be if you could hear people you know in hell screaming in torment? That doesn't sound like a nice place to be at all, really. And it's interesting, we don't know whether the Lazarus got to hear, but Abraham did, according to the story. You know, so the only point I would want to make is don't build your understanding of the afterlife on this, other than the principles that this teaches, which is entirely true. And in fact, I mean, there's a really important point here, which Jesus is basically saying, and this goes throughout the New Testament. He says, look, guys, you need to live today like it's the afterlife already. In other words, in the afterlife, the poor are going to be honored and fed, and the rich are going to be last. First will be last, the last will be first, right? Well, we don't have to wait for Jesus' second coming for that to be true. It should be true in the kingdom already. So we're seeing what things will be like in the afterlife with the poor comforted, the poor fed, the poor cared for, being the ethic for how we should live today. It's not just that sin gets punished, and we already knew that. It's that how God is going to reward us and punish us and what the afterlife is like is a model for what the kingdom should be like, the church should be like, how we should treat each other in this life. That makes sense? You read that in the books and the commentaries, and you go, I don't know what that means. They got fancy long words for it. It's called inaugurated eschatology, which is really too hard of a word to even worry with. But the concept is things are going to be perfect when Jesus returns. They're going to be great. And Jesus is going to set the world right. And whatever he's going to do is going to be what is right. But we don't have to wait on that. It can be true already in part. It will never be fully true until Jesus returns. But certainly, we are the heavenly community, we the church. We are the kingdom. I mean, that was beat into me since I was in diapers. The church is the kingdom, okay? What does that mean? Why do I care? Well, it means that the heavenly existence tells us what we anticipate. We should try to bring that about today in how we live, how we treat each other. You know, so when we read, for example, Acts chapter 2, there's 3,000 baptisms. Right, great passage on baptisms, all good, good with baptisms. But then, what do the people do after they're baptized? In Acts 2.
Have a fellowship with each other.
They have a fellowship. And what do they do with the fellowships? Indeed. They eat together, which is what we're going to do in heaven. They did it on Mount Zion, literally on Mount Zion. So when the prophet said, "In the kingdom comes, there will be a great feast," they thought, well, the kingdom's come, I guess we should eat together. Yeah. So it was fellowship meal. This church has never been guilty of this. I have been a member of churches where it was like, eat together? Why would we do that? Bible doesn't say eat together. We only come together to perform five acts of worship. Eating is not one of them. Therefore, we will not do that. See? But if you look at the world through afterlife eyes, you see what it's going to be like. God says in the end we're all going to be at a great banquet, and whether we'll be in chairs or lying on couches doesn't matter. But what does matter is we'll be eating together in fellowship with our fellow Christians, and that tells us what we ought to do today. And so the Acts 2 church took that quite literally. They didn't have to have a Bible lesson on how to eat together. They had read the prophets. And they knew they were supposed to eat together, see? And it also was a way, the other thing they did, which nobody ever says first, is they had everything in common, right? Which means they were such good friends that they shared what they had so that nobody was lacking. Again, that's the afterlife brought forward to the present because of the sacrifice of Christ and the kingdom and the church being the kingdom not fully realized, but being realized, if that makes sense. It's just another way of looking at it, but I think a really helpful way. So I do want to turn, if we can go to John 14:2. Yeah, good. One of my favorite passages. I have several favorite passages. Let not your hearts be troubled. Believe in God. Believe also in me. John 14. In my Father's house are many rooms. In the King James it says, mansions. If you're my age, you memorized that one as a child, right? Big difference. King James is just a bad translation. Even in 1611, this was known to be a bad translation. It was just a oops. Okay, they just messed up. Greek word sounds like mansion. Somebody forgot to actually look it up, I guess. I don't know. Wasn't there. But so when you see in heaven is pictured as a place of many mansions, which has made it into our hymnals, right? Then we picture heaven as people having giant estate lots. It's suburban America, except you got a 3-acre lot and you got a mansion, which is okay. I mean, that sounds good, kind of what most Americans are after anyway. But it was always a mixed metaphor because it says, in my Father's house. Well, there's only one house. If you translate it, not mansions, but as all the other translations say, as many rooms, then you get a very different picture, right? So if we all live in our own room in the great house of God, where do we eat breakfast? What? In heaven. but in the kitchen with God. Right? It's different. It's not that I have a mansion and I live really well and I have, you know, maybe servants to take care of me, who knows, and wonderful meals with just me. It is, I live in God's mansion. I have my own room in God's mansion. And when we eat together. It's a boarding house. Kind of archaic concept, but you know what I mean. And we're all in this place as one family in one house, sharing space with 4K high-definition TV, right? And we're sharing the TV screen with God. That's a different picture. Actually a little more interesting than that. If it were not so, I would have told you, I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and will take you to myself, that where I am, you may be also. And if you know the way to where I'm going. Right, so Jesus is saying not, I'm going to build a mansion for you. But rather, I'm getting a room ready. I know you're going to come. I got confidence you're going to make it. So I really need to have, you know, fresh linens on the bed and the room straight and ready, okay? But it's even really more than that, because this is from Ray Vanderlyn. Ray Vanderlyn points out that in the first century, when a couple was engaged, the bride would be just a little bit over the age of puberty. I mean, she would be very young. A husband probably 20. And what he would do is go to his father's house and build a room on the side of the house. And that was going to be their home. You know, so you know, for a lot of us, it's like, as soon as I can get away from my parents, the better. But in the first century, they were all about family. And the groom's job was to either take wood or stone or whatever, build a room adjacent to the father's house, common wall, not a separate building. That would be an apartment right there next to the father's house. And, of course, there'd be brothers and sisters all over the place. And in the yard, there'd be little nieces and nephews running around, right? That was how they lived. And the idea of going off to live by yourself, the reaction wasn't, you know, finally I get away. It was, how could anybody want to be so lonely? I can't imagine living apart from my family. And so it was, the bride was invited in to become a part of the family and live in that room. But he didn't build a kitchen. He didn't build a dining room. Didn't build a bathroom. Didn't build a playroom for the kids. That was all shared. You know, and they had typically a yard. And, you know, your kids and your nieces and nephews would all be in there together. And everybody was kind of family, raising them as a big family unit. So, and over again in the New Testament, in the Gospels, Jesus talks about the second coming as a wedding feast and as a bride and bridegroom being married. And that image is carried over in Revelation, talks about the wedding feast of the bride and bridegroom. Well, this is probably, can't prove it, but it makes sense, that this is also bridal imagery. And that's the concept is... and first century, the first century Hebrew and Greek had no word for privacy, had no concept of privacy, wouldn't have understood what that meant, because for one reason, they hadn't yet invented glass. You know, not the kind you can put in a window. You know, so, sorry, you and your wife have a fight? Everybody knows, because there is no place to go away from your folks and your siblings and your nieces and nephews, right? You know, and do they know what you're doing behind closed doors? Well, not really such a thing as closed doors. Door might be closed, but the window's open. I mean, it's very intimate. It's the kind of intimacy that most of us would rebel at as Westerners. I mean, we're very big on privacy rights. We've read it into our Constitution. It's so important to us, you know. And yet, in the first century, totally foreign concept. But Jesus then takes that idea and says, that's what heaven's going to be like. Now, here's a really scary thought. This should terrify you. The people who are going to be in heaven with us is us. Forever. If we can't get along in this world, what makes us think we're going to enjoy the next one? Because what are we going to be doing in the next world? Eating. Having fellowship. Sitting around the table with Abraham. Saying, do those things really happen like they said in the Bible? Tell me some more stories. Worshiping. That's what it says in the Hebrew, very near the end of Revelation, we're all going to be in worship. And over again, when Revelation pictures what life is like around God, what you see are people worshiping Him. Right? So our worship should be a preview of heaven. Again, it's bringing forward what we're going to be doing in the future to now. Now, I realize this is the Church of Christ, and they had harps in heaven, you know. But that's how it's pictured. But all these lessons that are in the Scriptures, in the Gospels, and in the letters about how to live as Christians, it occurred to me a while back that kind of the thing that runs through them all is people get along. Stop fighting. Figure out how to enjoy one another's company. Stop making each other miserable. So you read the Sermon on the Mount. A lot of ways to read it. People like to read it. I think one of the correct ways to read it is, look, not only are you not supposed to kill each other, which you've figured out you're good at that, you're not supposed to hate each other. In fact, not only are you not supposed to hate each other, you can't even call each other names. Well, why not? Well, A, you're not three-year-olds, right? And B, you've got to get along because you're going to be together forever. Name-calling doesn't get you there. You got to figure out how to get past that. So Jesus says, if your brother's got something against you, work it out. Well, we think, all right, well, maybe that's a condition to go into heaven, or maybe that's a requirement for taking the Lord's Supper. Well, really, it's about living together forever in community. Because we have a tendency to radically individualize the afterlife. We like the story about the mansion. We want to be in the 5-acre lot all by ourselves. But in fact, sorry, not going to be like that, you know. You're going to be with other people. And so it's not personal relationship with God entirely. It's not about personal salvation, individual salvation. Right? Jesus came to save the church. We're all going to be saved together. And church life together in community is supposed to be a preview, a down payment, a picture of what it's going to be like in heaven because it's so good today. And when we struggle for that to happen, we've got all these guidelines about how to live in Scripture, and we want to make them into rules about how to earn our way into heaven, which is really not quite the point. The point really is more, this is the kind of community I'm trying to form. This is how people should be. This is restores you back to the image of God as you were originally made in Genesis 1, and therefore makes you as happy and as joyous as possible by living this way. And you really need to get used to it and learn to like it because it's going to be this way forever. Right?
Jay.
Yeah.
You're talking about the rooms. It's so interesting. Kathy Morris took Maggie out for lunch last week to give her a heads up on what college life is like. And Maggie, she asked her what kind of room she was staying in. Maggie said, oh, I'm, you know, traditional dorm room, you know, small. Fourth floor, no elevator, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And Kathy told her there's actually a study that said that kids that stay in those like that are much happier than the kids that are in the suites, because they have to get out of their room. And they go out and they meet people where if they have their suites, they just tend to go in there and stay in their room.
Yeah.
So maybe having a dorm in heaven will make people get out. And, it's not about the room. It's about outside of that room together.
Yeah, actually, it's a huge irony because colleges... I mean, when I went to college, you had to have a roommate. There was no option, right? There were no single rooms. They weren't going to waste money on two sinks. Not, you know, no way. We're going to have one sink and maybe four people using it, you know, but at least two. And I went to Lipscomb, and we had in Sewell Hall shared men's restroom, all right? Well, now our kids are all spoiled. I mean, I remember looking through applications, and my number one criteria was, is there air conditioning? Yeah. I'm not going to a school where the dorms aren't air conditioned. That's back when hotels had signs, air conditioning, you know. Very novel thing. I know I'm very old and proving how old I am, but AC was new in college in the 70s. Right? Not all colleges had it, even today. Well, at least 15 years ago, Duke's freshman dorms don't have AC. Can you imagine? But our kids are spoiled, and they got lots of choices. And so to make them happy, the colleges started chopping the rooms up and giving you one-person room, because most of our kids grew up with their own room. I did not. I'm one of four, third of four, had two older sisters, younger brother. And, you know, when little brother came along, I shared a room. And most kids my age, that's kind of how you grew up. You had larger families and you shared rooms. And, you know, your friends who had a room all to themselves, it was just unthinkable bliss. I mean, how could you ever have that happen? So colleges now give you typically a choice of you get your own room. But the irony is that it's so lonely that the kids get out of the room and mingle and make friends. And it works out better for them, you know. But it's the opposite of what was intended, because they're hoping to get away, and what turns out to get with other people, but that's really what they enjoy more. Whereas in the kind of a lot of the dorms where you've got these suites, and in the doors in the hallways, like, you know, 75 feet apart before you get to the next door, it's hard to mix and mingle in the dorms. And my kids have been through that. Yeah, I totally agree. I think so. But it'll be Alabama football all the time, winning every game, right? Otherwise, just like it is here. Otherwise, it wouldn't be heaven. So we're about done, about out of time. Next week, I think we have covered most of the key afterlife passages at this point. I want to spend a little time summarizing kind of how I see things, and you do not have to agree with, but, you know, talk about a little bit more about Fudge's idea of conditionalism, which I agree with, and the new heavens and the new earth, and kind of how that affects how we live today. But I hope you've seen today, at least, that when we talk about this, it's not just theory, that it actually has a big implication for how we do church. And that all these afterlife passages are there not just to say, if you'll be good, you'll be rewarded. If you'll be bad, you'll be punished, which is true. Okay, those are very true statements. But it's not just that. It's also, there is this thread, these themes that run throughout Scripture from Genesis 1 to Revelation that talk about what the afterlife will be like. And it's God restoring us back to Eden, except better. And from that, when you understand that and see that, that helps us understand what the kingdom and the church are all about and intended to be. We're not just a society that worships in order to get brownie points, to have enough credits to get our way into heaven when we die. It's really about a radically transformed way of being. It's corporate. It's not just individual. It's us with other people. And, you know, made a big mistake in theology some time ago when we started talking about personal relationship with Jesus. Yes, we should have a personal relationship with Jesus, but we tend to take that as being enough. And the point is, and this is not enough, right? We're going to be with other people. We're going to be saved with other people. The kingdom is going to be saved. The church is going to be saved. Jesus came to save not just me. He's going to save us all together, and we're going to be together. And the more we learn about heaven, and the more we learn about the reason God's doing what he's doing and how it all fits together, the more we know about how to live today. And you see church, I hope, very differently. It's not just a great place to make friends or not just a place to learn the rules, but it's a place to kind of, let's call it, practice for the real game at the end. We're getting ready to live a different kind of life with people in a different world, played by different rules. And to some extent, we can enjoy that already if we just will. Make sense? All right. See y'all next week.